take your Bibles and turn to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 1. If you'll remember when we started talking about doing this split study, looking at the Kings on Sunday morning and the Chronicles on Sunday night, we said that you would see more information in the Chronicles about the priesthood, about the temple, about worship, and you would see more in the Kings about the Kings themselves and their lives. You'll notice that as we begin our study on Solomon. For example, we learned as we closed out our study on David, that David did a lot of preparation for the building of the temple before his death. Had the pattern from God that he gave to Solomon, brought all his people together, organized the people, and laid up all the gold and the silver and the bronze and the iron and the timber. Had just done so much footwork to make it easier for his son Solomon to actually build the temple. Well, if you look at the account in the Kings and look at the same account in the Chronicles, you'll notice when we get to the point that we start the construction of the temple, you'll see several chapters more in the Chronicles about the building of the temple than you do in the Kings. On the other hand, you'll see a little bit more detail about the life of Solomon in the Kings than you will in the Chronicles. So it's really beneficial to read these two books together to really get the totality of the life of each one of these kings and see the comparisons as you look at it compared to the Kings and the Chronicles. Now, notice, if you will, we begin 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 1, or chapter 1. And the first thing that we're going to notice as we studied in the Kings on Sunday morning, the account where Solomon asked for wisdom to be able to conduct the affairs of his kingdom. Notice what it says in verse 1 of chapter 1. Solomon, the son of David, was strengthened in his kingdom, and the Lord his God was with him and magnified him exceedingly. Then Solomon spake unto all Israel, to the captains of thousands and hundreds, to the judges and to every governor of all Israel, the chief of the fathers. So Solomon and all the congregation with him went to the high place that was at Gibeon, for there was the tabernacle of the congregation of God, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, had made in the wilderness. But the ark of God had David brought up from Kirjath-Jearim to the place which David had prepared for it, for he had pitched a tent for it at Jerusalem. Now remember, if you will, we looked at this in the latter part of David's life. One of the first problems that David got into was the moving of the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. And of course, he had to readdress that situation. And he made the comment that he did not move the Ark of the Covenant like God had specified. He did that and brought the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant to the city of Jerusalem. Remember, if you will, when he first took over as king, David was basically living and running his kingship out of the city of Hebron. So he makes the transition period from Hebron to Jerusalem after that first 7 years that he was ruling as king, and he kind of united the kingdom by bringing the people to Jerusalem. The tabernacle was there, and worship was done there. But notice here, this is something that we have talked about just a little bit. It was very easy for the children of Israel when they were following Moses and Joshua out in the wilderness to keep the tabernacle in one location and all of their their worship and all of their sacrifices were done in one place. But it seems to be the case that as they went into the land of Canaan, and as they lived under the judges, that there may have been a number of different places where they would go and make these sacrifices in places that they called the high places. Well, it seems to be that Gibeon was one of these places, and that's where they went on this particular occasion. It goes on and it talks about the burnt offerings that they offered here. And it says in verse 7, "In that night did God appear unto Solomon and said unto him, Ask what I shall give thee." Now, we've discussed this from the context of the kings. And, of course, one of the things that he asked for, as we pointed out on Sunday morning, was wisdom. And if you remember, when we were studying the life of David, when David was talking to Solomon, discussing his responsibility in the building of the temple, someone suggested to him that one of the things that he should wish for and ask for would be wisdom. Solomon did this very thing. Now, what did we, do you remember from Sunday morning what we said that God gave him? He asked for wisdom. He made the comment that I don't know how to come in and go out. We said that did not mean that he didn't know the front door from the back door. It just meant that he was young, he was inexperienced, and he wanted to rely upon and have the wisdom to make decisions that would be beneficial to his reign as king. We mentioned some other things on Sunday morning. What else did God give him after he asked for wisdom?
Riches.
What else? Yes, he did. Notice, if you will, we are seeing this over and over again. God would bless these people, and he would bless these kings. He would bless those judges. Moses did the same thing with the children of Israel after he gave them the law. Joshua did the same thing once he led them over into Canaan. But there was always a big little word there.
If.
What was that word?
If.
If. There was always that word if. God says, I'm going to do this if you will do this. Now, notice, if you will, one of the things that we talked about on Sunday morning as far as his wisdom was required, he was the smartest that had ever been leading up to his life. And he was the wisest of any that would come after him. Now, this is a tremendous statement. But yet, remember that in spite of his wisdom, in spite of his knowledge, the word if still stands in the middle of this. Just because he had that wisdom did not necessarily mean that he would exercise that wisdom in all choices of life. And we're going to see that become a reality as we began to look at the life of Solomon. Notice, if you will, he goes on and he makes the statement. In verse 12, "Wisdom and knowledge is granted unto thee, and I'll give thee wit, riches, wealth, honor, such as none of the kings have had before thee, neither shall there be any after." Then Solomon came from his journey to the high place that was at Gibeon to Jerusalem, from before the tabernacle of the congregation, and reigned over Israel. Now notice what it says in verse 14. Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, which he placed in the chariot cities, and with the king at Jerusalem. And the king made silver and gold at Jerusalem as plenteous as stones. Cedar trees made he as the sycamore trees. that are in the veil of abundance. Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt, linen yarn. King's merchants received the linen yarn at a price. And they fetched up and brought forth out of Egypt a chariot for 600 shekels of silver, a horse for 150. And so brought they horses for all the kings of the Hittites, the kings of Syria by their mans. Now what's going on here? What is taking place as Solomon takes over as the king, following in the footsteps of his dad, David?
Someone's building up an army or supplying his neighbors.
Yeah. You know, we talk about in our day, well, so-and-so has the Ford automobile dealership in the area. So-and-so has the General Motors dealership in the area. You want a Chevrolet car, you go down to so-and-so place and you can buy one there. You want a Ford automobile, you go here, Dodge down the road. Well, Solomon is basically setting up himself as the horse and chariot dealership in the country. Now, he's using connections with Pharaoh of Egypt because they were noted for breeding the most efficient, best horses, and especially chariot horses in the country. So everybody wanted horses and chariots from Egypt because it was the best horses and the best paid chariots. Well, Solomon comes in, and the first thing that he does is makes a deal with Pharaoh of Egypt to handle those horses. We're going to notice a little bit further that he had like 10,000 of these horses. Well, now remember when we talked about that, we talked about Solomon and his reign and how that he divided these people into 12 tribes. Each tribe had 1 month that they had to bring all of the provisions to Solomon, food, everything that was needed to take care of the temple, everything that Solomon needed, once a month, each one of those 12 tribes throughout the year had their allotted month. You bring all the provisions. Remember we said it was like 175 bushels of flour per month that Solomon needed to run the kitchen.
That was also what he feed the horses too, right?
Oh yes, that's what I was fixing to say. You're right. 375 bushels of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 grass-fed oxen, 100 sheep a month. All of this, these 12 tribes had to supply once a month. One tribe had to supply all this, plus all the straw and the hay and the corn and the barley to feed all these horses. So you can see the tremendous operation that Solomon, yeah, he needed some wisdom, didn't he? So you see him setting up his kingdom in the very early days. And he's going to set up, remember David's already taken over Moab and Edom and all the countries round about. They've got army battalions in those towns. He's overthrown those kings, and they're getting taxes from them. So Solomon makes a deal. He says, okay, now look, I'm getting the best chariots and the best horses out of Egypt. If you need some horses and chariots down in Edom, you call me. Moab, if you need some horses and chariots for your army, you need to call on Solomon. So you see, Solomon was kind of setting up the kingdom, not only for the benefit of himself, but he's kind of setting up a way to not only take care of himself, but he's going to set up a financial empire that's going to even add to all the wealth, all the gold, all the silver that he has already accomplished and all that David has already set up during that span of time leading up to David's death. So you kind of see from the Chronicles standpoint, very quickly in chapter 1, we get a little more detail on Sunday morning from the Kings about this particular activity of David's life, more detail. Then you get into chapter 2 of 2 Chronicles, and from 2 Chronicles 2 all the way to 2 Chronicles 7, it's going to tell us about the building of the temple. I was reading an article about the building of this temple. And people who study the details of this, they said you could take the dimensions of the tabernacle that Moses gave at the foot of Sinai, how to build it, how to make all the furniture that goes in it, how to break it down, how to move it around. And they said that if someone knew what they were doing and they were a good draftsman, they could draw out, sketch out that tabernacle, and you could kind of see it. Draw a picture of it, and you could see that tabernacle, and it would be pretty much to detail the way it was when they moved it from location to location. Back when I was a kid, and I'm 65 years old, there was a sister not far from us. I said, wow. There was a sister not far from us that spent a lot of time reading the description of that tabernacle, and she made little scale models about the size of this table here. And she would loan it out, and it was really something to behold and look at. And she just did that on her own. But they say that when you come down to sketching out the blueprint for the temple, it's almost impossible to get it ideally like you could have done the tabernacle. Says you can get it pretty close, but you don't know the exact dimensions. And then they said when Nebuchadnezzar came through later on and he took the children of Israel or Judah in captivity, that he ransacked that temple and destroyed so much of that temple that even the architects and the archaeologists that would come up behind later, they couldn't just really sit down and say, here's the way it is. Close to it, similar to it. They would even some way, they would fix the pillows of the temple in such a way that it wasn't the normal way of doing it. But now remember, where did this blueprint come from? God. Remember, David gave the pattern to Solomon in front of all the people that was to build. Well, they were talking about the temple itself. The main building, they said, was 90 by 30. And it was 45 feet high. It had a front porch across the front of it that was 30 by 90. Can you imagine a 30-foot wide porch? And then down the side of the structure, they came off each side and they had rooms. And they called it the storehouses. And those rooms were like 7.5 or 8 foot tall, and it was 3 stories high. And then you stop and think about that this temple was lined in pure gold. And these columns, and you talk about trim work. We go into some older homes and we see back when people went in and they finished out the interior of the house, and they, you know, they didn't run down to the lumber yard and buy them a stick of trim material. They were skilled craftsmen. Well, these people were skilled craftsmen. So that just kind of tells us something about the structure that we're going to be reading about in the next 5-6 chapters. Now, also taking into consideration what we've gone through leading up to this event. talking about 7 years it's going to take to get this structure finished. I was thinking, if I was reading this, as much trouble as I had building my little old house, I don't believe these contractors around Mountain View would have ever got that temple finished. Because Solomon worked 7 years on it. And look at the mass of people that he had, and he had it organized in such a way that he went through it and finished it in 7 years. No. Think about those stones. They said the walls were solid stones. They cut sawed those stones to where they stacked. Now remember where we've gone from. We've gone from the foot of Sinai, taking this tabernacle through the wilderness, over into the land of Canaan. We've gone through the judges. We've gone through two kings. We're getting to the third king of the United Kingdom. Some 480 years have gone by since Moses led those people out from under Mount Sinai. Now we're no longer worshiping in a tent, as he would say, or a temporary structure. We're now building that permanent structure. We talked about how the worship changed under David as opposed to Joshua and Moses and Judges. We drew a distinction between the tabernacle worship and the temple worship. Remember, one of the things that Moses did when he gave them the instructions to building the tabernacle, the furniture in the tabernacle, he gave them instructions as to how to move it from place to place. Not only that, but he even told the people, each tribe you locate here, another one you locate here. He had the marching orders as to how they were moving with that tabernacle. Well, now the tabernacle was going to be located in Jerusalem. No moving the tabernacle. No moving the ark of God. Not only that, but they're fixing to build a temporary or a permanent place, the temple. Now, notice also, if you will, you're probably talking about by this time, 480, 500 years have gone by since Moses gave them the law of Moses. You're looking at another 950, 975 years before the Son of God is brought into the world through the virgin birth of Mary. So you see where we're focused and where we're centered in this study throughout the Old Testament. Now notice, if you will, chapter 2 kind of fills us in. Remember, if you remember, David had a really good working relationship with the king of Tyre. What was Tyre as a country noted for? Timber. That's exactly what we read about in chapter 2 when we start building this temple. Solomon sent to Huram, the king of Tyre, saying, "As thou didst deal with David my father, and didst send him cedars to build him a house to dwell therein, even so deal with me. Behold, I build a house to the name of the Lord my God, to dedicate it to him, to burn before him sweet incense, for the continual showbread, for the burnt offerings, morning, evening, on the Sabbaths, and the new moons, on the solemn feasts of the Lord. This is an ordinance forever to Israel. And the house which I build is great, for great is our God above all gods." Isn't that a beautiful statement? Here's a young king now over Israel. A young king that's just communed with God, and God asked him what he can he do for him. And the young king says, "I need wisdom. Give me the wisdom, I'm young." Remember, David referred to him as young and tender. Told the people, "He needs your help. He's young and tender." God blesses him, tells him he'll be with him as long as he keeps his statutes and his judgments and his commandments. But he said, "If you don't, I'm going to rip this kingdom out of your grasp. Now, we're going to see that come into reality later on when Solomon forgets, fails to use the wise wisdom and judgment that he has, and succumbs to the pleasures of sin for a season in this world. Now notice, if you will, what it says. It says in verse 6, who is able to build him a house, seeing the heaven and the heavens of heavens cannot contain him? Who am I then that I should build him a house safe only to burn sacrifice before him? Send me thou for a man cunning to work in gold, silver, brass, iron, purple, crimson, blue. A man that can skill to grave with the cunning men that are with me in Judah and in Jerusalem, whom David my father did provide. Send me the cedar trees, he says. So you see, he's following up with what David had reminded him and instructed him to do. Call the king of Tyre. I've made a league with him. He's friends of mine. He'll help you any way that he can. Notice, if you will, in verse 11 it says, then the king of Tyre answered in writing, which he sent to Solomon, because the Lord hath loved his people, he hath made thee king over them. Isn't that amazing? Now, that's what God wants. He wants people to look at his chosen people, the Israelites. He's looking at David, seeing the life that David lived. Though he did make some mistakes, he was still a man after God's own heart. And the king of Tyre could look at David and look at Israel and says, your God is over you. That's what he wanted. That's what he wanted Israel to be able to do. That's the reason he brought them out of Egyptian captivity. He didn't want all those plagues to fall upon Pharaoh. He didn't want all those Egyptian people to die. He wanted them to see his mighty hand in action and respond and depend on him and lay aside those Egyptian gods. That's what he wanted Edom and Moab and the countries round about to do. He wanted to see in his people. Tyre saw that. The king of Tyre saw that in David. He sees it in Solomon, and he responds very positively and says, whatever you need, I'm here. How could that apply to us today? Okay, that's true.
And from eternal.
That's true. What else does that teach us?
Ask.
Pardon?
Ask the Lord.
Okay.
Pray.
Okay. Have you thought about that's what God wants out of us too? He wants us to live lives every day that will cause people to look at us and examine our lives and the decisions that we make and the way we conduct ourselves and our speech and say, you know, there's something different about those people. Why do they act like they do? Why do they live like they live?
He wants us to have our heart right.
Yes, he does. He definitely wants us to have the same heart that David had. So that when our heart is right, what comes out of our heart is going to be right. And that is what makes the difference in being able to reach people with the gospel. That's what makes it easier for us to attract people to change their minds and worship God the way the Bible teaches that you're to worship. Because they see people who have hearts that are tender, that are humble, that are merciful. And they do what they do, not because they're afraid of going to hell, though we don't want to go to hell. We do it because we love God, love His Son, and understand that had it not been for Him and that sacrifice on the cross of Calvary, we would be doomed to hell. And we want to send that message to a lost and a dying world. We go on and notice, if you will, you start in chapter 3, and we're just about out of time. But chapter 3 begins with the location of the temple. He's already made contact with the king of Tyre. He's got everything together. He's already heard what he's going to do. And it says he began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem in Mount Moriah. What's special about Mount Moriah? If you remember, as David was numbering the people, he got into problems with God because he numbered a certain group of people that God didn't want numbered. And he gives David three choices. And David says, look, if I'm going to be punished, if my people are going to be punished, I want to be punished by Jehovah God. I don't want to fall into the hands of a foreign king. I don't want to fall into the hands of anyone else. I want my God. And if you remember, he put a plague on David and the people, and a lot of people died. And this curse was stayed on Mount Moriah. And David goes to the threshing floor of Araunah or Nodon, and he asks for the material to offer these sacrifices and to build an altar. And Araunah said, look, I'll give you everything you need. David said, I would not offer to Jehovah my God that which cost me nothing. Good lesson there for us, isn't it? He says, I'll buy it. So this is the same place now where David, Solomon's father, had purchased the threshing floor to build the altar to sacrifice to Jehovah God and stop the stay of the curse that was placed upon him and the people toward the end of David's life. And so this is going to be where he starts building the temple. And it just basically goes on, and notice, if you will, in verse 4, it talks about the porch. In verse 5, it talks about the greater house he sealed with fir tree, which he overlaid with fine gold and set thereupon palm trees and chains. He garnished the house with precious stones for beauty and gold. In other words, he decorated it. He overlaid the house, the beams, the posts, the walls, the doors with gold, engraved cherubims on the wall. Talks about the most holy part of the house. He made the two cherubims that would hang in that location. Talks about the width of them, and the wings were like 30 feet, these cherubims, these angelic beings. And like I said, we really run past time. I want to get David to start ringing that bell on to get to stop on time. Let's stop right here. We'll pick up in Kings on Sunday morning. We'll start back in chapter 4 next Wednesday night, finish building the temple, and then talk about Solomon dedicating.